This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, John Moe's wits combines sketch comedy, interviews, and music, but don't call it a variety show. But first, in his radio series, The Things They Carry, U.S. Soldiers in Afghanistan, Jake Warga takes inspiration from Tim O'Brien's Vietnam War book, The Things They Carried, as he documents some of the physical objects and emotional memories carried by U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. Warga is an independent radio producer who spent time chronicling the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan while embedded with troops there. Earlier this week, Jake joined us from his home base in Morocco to talk about his series. It's funded in part by the Global Story Project with support from the Open Societies Foundation and is presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. It will begin airing later today on All Things Considered as part of WNPR's Coming Home Project.
I was in Iraq 2010, and I was reading The Things They Carried by Tim O'Brien. I thought, well, God, this is a beautiful way of trying to understand soldiers' experiences through literature, because he says that all war stories are a love story and all war stories need to be told in this way and through literature. So I thought, well, radio, that's pretty close to literature. So I just decided to go back into the theater, back into battle, and talk with soldiers in Afghanistan and ask them what they carry with them, what they carried from home, both physically and emotionally. And then also what they carry and what they find in the field and what they carry home with them, again, both physically and emotionally. There's talismans, there's little things that become so much more important the longer that they hold on to them.
We're talking with journalist Jake Warga about the American soldiers he profiled in Afghanistan for his series, The Things They Carry, U.S. Soldiers in Afghanistan. He told us about some of the emotions, the memories, and the physical objects that they carry with them each day.
Some of the advantages, they have so many pockets. So there's lots of room to sort of collect things. And they have multiple deployments, many of them, so they're collecting memories. And we're in the 21st century, so they have Facebook. They have email. They have all these things. But still, there's this urge to have to hold something that will possess all the memories of that deployment or that experience. And for example, in Pace, he's a medic. And I went to him because I wanted to ask him about the actual physical weight of what soldiers have to carry. I mean, they have ballistic plates. They have all their ammo and their weapons. And there's so much stuff that they have to carry that I wonder, do they have a chiropractor on bases? So Jason Pace, Captain Pace, was actually trained to do chiropractic adjustments. So I went to him because I also had to wear all this stuff and it was getting really hard on my back. So I started to talk to him about, well, the physical things that they carry. I mean, it's such an extreme weight.
Here's Captain Jason Pace speaking to journalist Jake Warga.
A lot of our American soldiers, they're required to wear their combat helmet, a couple pounds there. And then you got your body armor, ceramic plates that try to help prevent rounds from going through. And that adds on several more pounds. Then you add on your ammunition and your weapons, any other gear that they need to be carrying. That's not including any rucksack and all their other supplies. If they're out on a dismounted patrol, you could add on 60 pounds or more easily onto a soldier. And they're carrying this day and night for the most part for days to weeks on end.
And when talking with Pace a little further, I asked him, so what are you going to carry back home with you after this deployment? And he said that the heaviest things for him to carry are the unanswered questions and the memories and the friends that he's lost in battle or in combat. And that's what he's taking with him. And that is really the heaviest thing that anyone can take home from battle or memories, because you can't get rid of them. You will carry those with you for the rest of your life. And that's what part of Tim O'Brien talks about too, the incredible weight of the memories and the experiences. And that sometimes they can be an immense burden, and often they are, and they're hard to get rid of. But some don't want to get rid of them because those are the memories of their friends.
Once again, here's Captain Jason Pace.
In my career, I have had friends and fellow service members killed in action, yes. It's hard. You carry the burden of asking questions. Why? Why them, not you? Seeing their loved ones again. Yeah. Sometimes you never get to say goodbye to them. It is a burden you carry. but it's a burden that we know we take the chance of facing as service members.
That was the voice of Captain Jason Pace, a physician's assistant working in Afghanistan, one of five soldiers featured in Jake Wargo's series, The Things They Carry, U.S. Soldiers in Afghanistan, which begins airing today on All Things Considered on WNPR. Jake recently joined us for an interview about this series. He shared the story of another U.S. soldier he met there, Staff Sergeant Christian Cohen, whose mementos serve as physical reminders of the dangers of serving.
Well, this is probably the most important thing I'll take home. This is when you blow up an IED, the pin that you stick in. You stick it in the C4, you put it on the IED, and then they walk the line back and blow it up, and this is actually the trigger pin you push down. Well, the team made us all keychains out of it, so I thought it was pretty cool. It's my keepsake.
I talked with her one night in the barracks, and she had all these little doodads, these little talismans, which a talisman is, you know, an object that becomes sort of sacred, that it possesses so much more to it than being just that one object. And she has a piece of shattered glass she showed me from her first sort of close encounter with an explosion.
I have a little piece of glass that I'm bringing back with me. I was our first mission that I went on with Apache Troop when we got attacked. And they hit our truck with two mortars and RPG, and it busted out all the glass. So each one of us took like a piece of the glass to take home with us.
And most everyone has either something that they brought from home that they carry with them, or something that they will take from their deployment and carry with them back home.
One of the more intimate stories brought home came from a 21-year-old bomb technician named Specialist Lackey.
What fascinated me with Lackey is he was just talking. He's 21 years old, and he's got a kid back home, and he has pictures of her all around. But he's also carries with him, he pulled out his dog tags, which is a very intimate thing for a soldier. He showed me his dog tags, and there's this little doohickey on the end of it, and it turned out to be an urn with his father's ashes in it. So what he's carrying his father with him everywhere when he's on deployment.
Here's Specialist Lackey talking to Jake Warga about Lackey's father.
My dog tags, and right there you can see it looks almost like a little thimble. It's actually an urn, and it's my father is in there. And I always bring it with me on every mission to have my father with me. I wasn't really close to my dad. It was maybe the last year before I joined the Army that I was really starting to get close to him. And I was away at training. When he died, I wasn't really a part of it. It just means something to me that he's around now because I finally became close to him. I didn't get to speak to him maybe the last couple weeks of his life, because he was so sick that he couldn't even speak to me. He didn't remember who I was on the phone. I don't know, I guess it's almost me trying to show him what I am now, what I've become. And he only got to live through my training in the Army, so he actually never got to see me become an EOD tech, which is probably the biggest thing in my life right now. I think that's really the only thing I try to carry with me at all times. And I always feel it like right around my heart, so I just always feel like he's always there.
When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Jake Warga about his series, The Things They Carry, U.S. Soldiers in Afghanistan, which will begin airing on All Things Considered today on WNPR. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're listening to an interview with Jake Warga. He's an award-winning independent journalist currently based in Morocco. He's also the producer of The Things They Carry, U.S. Soldiers in Afghanistan. It's a radio series inspired by Tim O'Brien's Vietnam War book, The Things They Carried. Jake talked to us about his experiences in Afghanistan, about the soldiers he met there, and about their desire to share their stories with him.
They all want to tell their story, and that's the thing. An army is made up of soldiers, lots of soldiers, and that's the forest. That's the perspective of looking at the forest. But I went and tried to find the trees, you know, each individual soldier, and talk to them and understand through all those little pieces the overall experience. And some would be just almost queuing up, wanting to speak with me.
Speaking with the soldiers, Jake learned about the many hardships of war, about the physical and emotional burdens that soldiers carry with them both during deployment and after.
They're exhausted. They're absolutely exhausted. I've heard stories in Afghanistan by soldiers when they were serving in Iraq and multiple deployments. And physically, they're just so messed up from all the weight that they have to carry. Plus now psychologically and, you know, they're just messed up from the memories and the constant deployments. And we are a very tired force, yes. And I would hear stories, I mean, 13, 12 years when I was there. So it's definitely the longest running war now. And I talked with Captain Rich Evans, who loved the book. He had read the book many times. And that was sort of my entree into talking to people, say, hey, have you read this book? And a lot of them had, because maybe they come from a military family and their fathers or they wanted them to read this book. So talking with Captain Rich Evans about when he first came, I thought it was really insightful that he said he brought a lot of naivety with him the first tour.
Things I carry. My first deployment, I think I carried naivety. War wasn't like the movies, and there's seldom firefights back then. I grew up knowing my dad was a decorated vet in Vietnam, and the dad definitely was not happy that I enlisted after working so hard to put me through college. I went to college to be an English teacher, but I carried that, and then carried the knowledge that my wife was pregnant with my daughter Kennedy at the time.
That was the voice of Captain Rich Evans. He's one of five U.S. soldiers featured in Jake Warga's series, The Things They Carry, U.S. Soldiers in Afghanistan. He joined us to talk about the series, which begins airing on All Things Considered on WNPR. Jake Warga spent time embedded with troops in both recent U.S. wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I asked him to share some thoughts about the memories that he carried away from his experiences.
There is always that sense of adventure of being in a conflict zone, but as any soldier will tell you, bravery, and I think Napoleon mentioned this, comes not from moments of crisis, but how to deal with the boredom. And just like in Vietnam, soldiers would have, USO would have movies or books, basically, that you disappear into stories. And that's what the beauty of literature does, is to try to put life into perspective. And soldiers now, they all have their laptops. And so I downloaded gigabytes of movies to take home, because they all watch movies on their laptops. But a lot of them, it's not always negative things that they took home. A lot of people I talked with would be taking home chai tea, a lot of chai tea. They loved Afghan chai. And they would compare it to Iraqi chai tea, which I thought was interesting. So a majority of them preferred Afghan chai tea. And the culture, and those who interacted with the locals and got to know some of the culture, and once they got past the frustrations of dealing with that, they actually started to learn about what can we learn from this culture as well, which includes greetings. So greeting ceremonies would take so long, but they started to get into this. And so they're shocked sometimes when they go back and people don't go through these long greeting processes. But what I took from it is, well, I was sad. I'm always sad when I go to places where things are going on that just seem so out of control, that I always wonder, why are we there and everywhere? And I heard that sentiment a lot from soldiers. And we were handing off a base to them while I was there, and it just felt like they were not ready. The Afghan army was not ready. And I thought, oh my gosh, we're leaving the army. We're giving them whatever knowledge and skills that we can and weapons, and then we're just leaving them. And no one believes that they're ready. And that's the beauty of talking to foot soldiers, not talking to the brass, because the brass will always give you the positive messages, and not always the true messages, I found. So it's talking to the foot soldiers, talking to the people on the ground and finding out what's going on, to me was the most valuable takeaway.
One thing that soldiers have always carried with them is music. Instead of fifes and drummers, though, soldiers now have iPods and iPhones with them. A few years back, Jake Warga spoke to soldiers in Iraq during another series about the music that they carry with them. Here's Major James Lockridge talking to Warga about what's on his iPod in Iraq.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy?
I'm James Lockridge.
Caught in a landslide.
It's new to me. This is my first iPod I've ever owned, but I've downloaded a few songs over the past few days.
Open your eyes.
Got the Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. What I really love about this thing is the podcast. So I've got a bunch of programs from NPR, Two Talk of the Nations, the 7 a.m. News, Car Talk, which I'm still working through, and the last two, This American Life. So different than the last two rotations, but yet you're still in Iraq, and it's over so many years, it just seems like it's more of a story now than a song.
Mama just killed a man, put a gun against his head, pulled my trigger, now he's dead.
The United States Army can go anywhere, at any time, at any place, you know, and face anybody. And I learned that during the first war, and with overwhelming firepower. I would never want to be anybody that had to face the United States. After OIF won, I mean, everybody really thought the war was over. I didn't foresee this insurgent campaign coming on, but now we're back. But I think I'm done again. I mean, they got it. Could we stay here another 20 years or more? Absolutely. Do you have violence? Absolutely. Do you have corruption? Absolutely. Can the Iraqis do it on their own? Yes. That's really my prognosis for here. It's time to wrap this thing up, get the elections done, and, you know, head on home and let the Iraqis do it. And they want to do it.
That's Major James Lockridge speaking to producer Jake Warga about what he listens to on his iPod in Iraq. Thanks to Jake for joining us to talk about his series, The Things They Carry, U.S. Soldiers in Afghanistan. This series is part of the Global Story Project with support from the Open Society Foundations and is presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. It starts airing today on All Things Considered on WNPR. Coming up, we'll listen to a conversation with John Moe, host of the public radio show Wits. He'll be in Hartford tomorrow to moderate the Connecticut Forum's season finale event, Nerdfest, Why Nerds Rule the World. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, the CDC estimates that 1 in 26 people will be diagnosed with epilepsy in their lives. Annually, the disease costs more than $15 billion in medical costs and reduced work production. Historically, people with epilepsy were thought to be possessed by demons, and although research has come a long way from those days, the disease remains mysterious. Coming up, we'll discuss this neurological condition, and you can join the conversation on the next Where We Live. Tomorrow, the Connecticut Forum hosts its season finale, Nerdfest, Why Nerds Rule the World. The moderator of the event is John Moe. He hosts the public radio show Wits, which you can hear on WNPR Saturday nights at 9. It's recorded in front of a live audience at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota. His guests include actors, comedians, musicians, and authors, including all three panelists at tomorrow's Connecticut Forum, Mythbusters Adam Savage, author Chuck Klosterman, and actress Aisha Tyler. Heard in this Wits sketch with John Moe and Jamie Winterbauer.
If I don't sell 100 of these meditation tapes, Tom Waits is going to keep my dog and make Buster love him more than he loves me.
I told you to keep quiet, Jamie Winterbauer.
Wait, how can he hear us?
I'm Tom Waits.
He's Tom Waits.
Now pour an old Budweiser and a ground-up Lucky Strike into your Walkman. I'm starving. Who's a good boy, Buster?
Man, this is a weird show.
Tom Waits meditation tapes. Buy them today, please. I love that dog.
John Moe, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, we're going to be talking about your show Wits in just a little bit, but first I want to talk about this Nerd Fest that you're hosting for the Connecticut Forum. And I guess the appropriate first question is, are you a nerd?
Isn't it funny that Nerdfest is an actual title now and not a pejorative put down of an event? Like, it's something people take pride in now. I'm certain strains of nerd. I'm a comedy nerd. I'm a music nerd. I'm a few other types of nerd. I'm actually getting tutored on nerd nomenclature by my 13-year-old son because he says, well, yeah, I found a good group of nerds to be with at school. And I'm like, wait, you're hanging out with the nerds? And he's like, no, Dad, it's okay. Everybody's a nerd now. And, you know, we're just different types of nerds. So he's with the academic nerds, the history nerds, and there are other, you know, there's nerds, there's Doctor Who nerds, which is a whole subset. So apparently everybody's a nerd. So I guess yes.
Well, it's interesting, though, too. I think that the nerds that I grew up with, and I suppose I was one of them, were nerds who were in band. I mean, that was essentially, you didn't play football, you were in
right.
band, therefore you were a nerd. And then there's this other strain, though, that goes down the Star Trek, Doctor Who realm. But I guess, you know, for this conversation that you're holding, it is such a broad term, and it has a lot to do with just people who are engaged in science and in learning. That part of the nerd world seems to be less pejorative. It seems to be more like why nerds rule the world. Like they're the ones who are going to end up making all the money by having a new, you know, phone app or something.
Yeah. I think nerd is sort of synonymous with enthusiast to a certain degree. Like people who get excited about things, get excited about specific things, kind of catch on to that title. I mean, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and I had a computer very early on. And I, like at age 12 or 13, I was writing computer programs that could predict the outcome of football games. And I was actually doing pretty well, like with accuracy. But then I thought, well, you know, there's no way to connect this computer to other computers, obviously. So there's no way this information will ever get out. So I'm just going to give up programming and listen to heavy metal records in my room, which was a miscalculation. And because just a few years earlier across town, another couple of nerds, Bill Gates and Paul Allen, stuck with the computer programming. And I think it worked out pretty well for them.
It worked out pretty well for them. But, you know, they didn't have big public radio careers to fall back on.
No, that's right. They only wish. They only became billionaires because they couldn't hack it as public radio hosts.
You know, we're talking about this in a week that I don't know if you saw this. It went viral within our community. That memo that NPR sent out 20 years ago alerting
yes.
everyone to the Internet. Did you see this memo?
I love that memo. My favorite part of it, the part I tweeted, the line I tweeted was, for others, this will have no effect at all. Yeah. And also the lack of definite article on internet.
Yes.
We will have internet.
We will have internet. You can use internet if you want. If you don't worry about it.
Yeah, don't worry about it. It's not going to be disruptive to broadcasting in any way.
Well, it's very interesting that it's just 20 years ago, John, and I'm sure you're talking about listening to heavy metal records. We can remember very clearly the records we listened to 20 years ago as if we just listened to them. But somehow or other, this thing called internet just creeped up on us, and now it's been here, and it's changed our lives. And we look back at 1994, and we think, how the hell did that happen?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, now when a new record comes out, I'm like Tuesday mornings, I spend a fair amount of time on Tuesday mornings on Spotify just saying, wonder what all the new releases are. Oh, I heard about that record. I think I will listen to it instantly now. And And it's hard to describe. I mean, I have a 5-year-old daughter also, and my 13-year-old son enjoys telling her about video stores, like video rental stores, because she just cannot grasp what he's saying, and he thinks that's very entertaining.
Do you think that you would have been a much different kid growing up if internet had been around? I mean, if you wouldn't have had to struggle to find information, if you would have found different things funny along the way?
I think it lets you you don't have to want it as bad. You know, to get your information, you don't have to really seek it out as bad. But I think and so I think maybe you lose something a little bit with that. You lose some of the passion for the types of nerd you are, for those areas of nerdpertise that you really want to dive into. But on the other hand, I think kids growing up today can take deeper dives. They can get I talk to my kids and my kids' friends, and it's not that they're reading everything on a Wikipedia page about a subject, is they're going to the resources listed at the bottom of the Wikipedia page. And so they're using it as a jumping off point. And I mean, I would have given my left arm for something like that, to like just be able to get on one of the many screens around the house and then do a deep dive to all these different resources that are available. So I don't think the passion is as big, but I think they probably get more and more detailed information.
Yeah, I'm pining for all that lost time, either riding the bus to the library, then spending time looking up things, and then
microfiche. Yes, microfiche, the guide to periodical literature. Do you remember that one where you had to look up magazine articles?
It's almost amazing, frankly, that we found out any information at all.
Well, and it makes you wonder what in 20 years, you know, my kids will be telling my grandkids. You know, when I was young, we had to go all the way to a computer to look this stuff up. We had to type it in on a QWERTY keyboard. We couldn't just think about it and have our eyeball chip projected in front of our faces like you kids have today.
I know. They just won't have any real understanding of the horrors that we had to endure.
We had to walk to the computer both ways in the snow uphill.
We're talking with John Moe. He's the host of Wits, which you can hear Saturday nights at 9 on WNPR. He is also the moderator for the Connecticut Forum coming up tomorrow night called Nerdfest, Why Nerds Rule the World. You can find out more about that at ctforum.org. As we talk about the internet and other nerd-related items, I want to talk to you about your time hosting Marketplace Tech Report. And I have to say,
sure,
we still carry Marketplace Tech Report on the air, and I think it's a very good program. It provides an excellent service. But we all miss you doing this show. And part of the reason we miss you doing the show is it was in the morning, it was funny, and it was something that took a look at technology in a way that I think a lot of us really look at technology when we're sitting around with our friends or we're in the newsroom, as opposed to the way technology is often reported on the radio or certainly in the Wall Street Journal. Tell me a bit about how you decided to take on tech reporting during that show.
You know, I had done a tech show when I lived in Seattle at the station there, and I was an editor at Amazon.com in some of the early days of Amazon, relatively early days of Amazon, not early enough that I became a millionaire myself. And so it was always of interest to me. It was always something that I followed. And then they offered me a chance to do that program. And my approach from the beginning was I wanted to demystify it, because I was never, like, I couldn't figure out how a lot of these things worked. I wasn't an engineer, but I thought it would be a valuable service, especially when I looked at a lot of the tech coverage, to say, okay, here's the technology news. What does it mean to me? How is this going to affect my life? What's it going to mean to what I buy, to what I drive, to how I learn things, to how I, as a regular guy, function in society? And it was a fun challenge, too, because it was a 4-minute show with a couple of different segments in it. So it was really like writing haiku. You know, we didn't have time to natter on and on about something. We had to just distill it to pure crystal form and then try to slide a few jokes in there along the way, too.
Part of the, I think, issue with business reporting, and there is so much of it, not just on the various marketplace programs, but on 24-hour cable channels and, of course, newspapers and online services devoted entirely to this, is almost everything, including the technology that you covered, is seen through a lens of how this will make me money or not make me money.
Right.
And I think that the inherent beauty, passion, craziness of just the fact that these items exist and can help our lives be better is lost in all that. We lose sometimes an awful lot of the joy of discovery that comes with a new piece of technology.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. Is you know, what will this mean to the way I live my life as it currently is? I mean, I was never really very interested in what this story will mean to the share price of Google or of Apple or of any of these other places. Like, that's just not part of my world. But what it means for how I watch TV shows or how I, you know, what my kids are learning at school, and if my kids are going to have iPads instead of books pretty soon, that matters to me, and I want to know about that. And I think, you know, there's some technology reporting out there that's like that, but I think I really need to find out more about that. When it comes to something with technology, I mean, I always say technology is just people dealing with a problem and then thinking it through and innovating. Like, that's really all technology is. I mean, dating back to the wheel and fire, people said, okay, I'm cold. What can I do about it?
Let's solve this problem.
I'm going to use this new stick and flint technology that's out.
We're talking with John Moe, the host of WITS, and he's going to be the moderator for the Connecticut Forum coming up this weekend. Nerdfest, Why Nerds Rule the World. Find out more at ctforum.org. So let's talk about WITS. Sure. As we talk about technology and we talk about nerddom and all these things that seem very current, an old-fashioned variety show. I mean, that's basically what you're doing, right? You're doing like the oldest form of vaudeville variety show in your form. How did you decide to do WITS in the form that it is right now?
You know, we had been doing this interview series just locally here in Minnesota for a couple of years. We were bringing in funny authors, and I've written a book before. I've got a new book coming out in June, and so I knew a fair number of people in the literary world who were funny and lively interviews. And we had a musician, John Munson, on stage with us for these things, sort of providing some interstitial music. And then I think what happened is we had a really great time doing it. People responded to it. And then John Munson and I kind of both amped up our own areas of expertise. So he started bringing in guest musicians and beefing up a band. I started adding in comedy sketches and sort of improvisational kind of situations to lift it above just the standard interview on stage that I think happens in a lot of areas. And the more we did that, the more we pushed it, the more people responded. And we started not so much authors, but bringing in really funny, smart, lively comedians and actors who really had something to say. And I think that's when it started to snowball. And then before you knew it, it was a national show. I mean, it's the kind of thing, like, we don't use the word variety show a lot because I think it has, for a lot of people, associations with something older, with the Carol Burnett Show and with Flip Wilson, both of whom are brilliant, of course, but it didn't sound as contemporary. But you're right. I mean, that is what it is. I mean, we are passionate about comedy and thought and music, and so we just round up people we adore and bring them on stage and have fun with them.
We're going to hear just a few clips from the show. And again, WITS is heard on Saturday nights at 9 o'clock on WNPR. You have recurring characters and segments, things like Murder Cat and pop song Murder correspondences. And you do a version of Tom Waits. And
yes.
I want to listen to a segment where you, as Tom Waits, do an audio tape helping people get the songs from Frozen out of their heads. This clip also features Bobcat Goldthwait. Let's listen.
I brought in a friend, 1980s Bobcat Goldthwait. Hey, how's everyone doing out there? 1980s Bobcat, there's a song called Do You Wanna Build a Snowman? Can you do your version?
Sure. Do you wanna build a snowman? Sure, why? Why would you build a snowman? It's just like Oliver North. It'll melt when it's on trial.
And now that we have the current version of Bobcat Goldthwait back, yes, on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, it's interesting to hear the 1980s Bobcat Goldthwait again.
Yeah, that's present day Bobcat as 1980s Bobcat.
I love that idea. How did you decide that one of your characters was going to be the great Tom Waits?
Tom Waits. Well, I mean, I adore Tom Waits and have, you know, loved his music most of my life. I think, like everybody, you know, you kind of develop a Tom Waits kind of voice listening to it. And I took it as a challenge as somebody who talks for a living. Like, can I do Tom Waits without ripping up my throat?
Yes.
And then I got a tip. The first time we did that voice, that sketch, was last fall when Aisha Tyler was the guest on the show, and she's going to be a part of this Nerdfest coming up. And I was talking to Aisha about it and how I was kind of struggling with it. I was debuting this thing. She said, well, the secret is Tom Waits isn't a scratchy voice. He's drowning. You know, so drink a bunch of water. So it's not like this, because that's unsustainable, but it's like this, you know, and then I added to that something I noticed about Waits, which is holding on final consonants. Like, I got to pick up the phone. And so, you know, where's my keys? So you hold the consonant and then you release some breath at the end of it. And that communicates all the fatigue and whiskey and lucky strikes that you need.
I have to ask you, and I'm sure you've spoken with this with your folks who distribute you in American public media, but of course Tom had a well publicized run-in with Cheetos some years ago. Or has there been any legal
Fritos.
Action? Fritos. Was it Fritos or Cheetos?
Yes, I think it was Fritos.
I'm worried about you now, John. Is there any chance that he's going to bring a lawsuit against you for?
I think this is fair satire. If we're saying that it's Tom Waits and it's obviously me, you know, big credit for that segment was I didn't actually come up with it. One of our writers, Mike Fotis, came up with the idea. And I always love it when any of my writers comes to me with like an idea that they present of, okay, this idea is insane and it's never going to work, but here it is. And I'm like, okay, that's always the one that ends up being my favorite.
Another one of your regular segments is Pop Song Correspondences, and I want to play a clip of this where you play the role of Axl Rose's editor for the Guns N' Roses song Sweet Child of Mine.
Redundant. You either have a memory or you're reminded of something. You're not reminded of a memory.
Where everything was as fresh as the bright blue sky.
Yeah, I asked around the office and no one is sure a sky that is blue is necessarily fresh. You could have a blue sky at the end of a long, sweaty day and there would be nothing fresh about it. And she reminds you of a time when things were fresh? Fond recollections of freshness are no foundation for love. Fix.
He's the world's most annoying editor.
Yes. Yeah, that one dates back to, God, that's an old idea that I turned into a relatively recent radio piece. I started writing those pop song correspondences, which are basically letters based on whatever is brought up in the lyrics of a song. Those have been on the McSweeney's website for years, Dave Egger's website. I've been writing it for there for a long time, just for print. And I think Sweet Child of Mine was one of my first, because there's so many. It's obvious so often in that song that Axl is just reaching for a rhyme.
Yes.
That he's just trying to pile up the syllables in order to get to the end of the, in order to fit the meter. So, you know, she's got a smile that it seems to me reminds me of childhood memories. Like, okay, it seems that way to you. Ergo, you are writing it.
You are writing it.
And it reminds me of a memory. I think that line just stuck with me. And then the editor built on from there. And, you know, I've been an editor and I've had many editors. So the voice of the editor who doesn't quite get the thing that you're going for, which is dumb heavy metal, was pretty fresh in my mind. So that was easy to summon.
You know, we were talking before about whether or not Wits is a variety show, which is a very old-fashioned notion, or something new. Now, you share a home theater with the Prairie Home Companion at the Fitzgerald Theater there. Tell me about how much influence
a
Ferrari
here?
Home
had. I had no idea.
You'd never
really?
Seen them. There's a guy named Garrison Keillor.
Hold on, you're comparing our show to theirs? Wow.
Now, come on. Now you
just blew my mind.
Clearly, this is something that you think about a lot. How much influence has Garrison Keillor had on you?
Garrison Keillor is a brilliant genius who built so much of what we know and many times take for granted about public radio. But what's interesting for me is that he was a hero of mine as a writer long before I had ever heard A Prairie Home Companion. When I was in college, I got a book of his essays, about just his humor essays. A lot of them, I think, were written for The New Yorker. And I just marveled over them. I just parsed every sentence because it was so, his writing was so funny and smart and I was raised by Norwegians. My parents are Norwegian immigrants, and the Norwegian sense of humor is incredibly dry. My dad used to make jokes that I wouldn't even realize were jokes until days later. He was so dry about it and so clever. And so I think that's what I really responded to. And because I didn't grow up listening to a lot of public radio. And then when I heard the show and when I heard the Lake Wobegon monologues, obviously I marveled at it all over again. That being said, we don't really think of our show as being all that similar to his. I think he's got his thing and we've got our thing. I mean, I admire him to death, but there's never a part in our show where I say, okay, Prairie Home does this. Let's do that. Let's do our thing the same way, or let's do our thing the opposite way. It doesn't inform those choices. But as a creative titan, of course, Garrison Keillor's right up there for me with Tom Waits and David Letterman and many of the other gods in the pantheon.
Well, we talked about Tom Waits, and we referenced Axl Rose just a moment ago. My producer, Tucker Ives, who works with me on the show, is a big fan of Chicken Starship. Can you just tell us about Chicken Starship quickly?
Oh, yeah. Well, he's one of many fans, of course. Yeah, when I was in Seattle for years and years, I was in in two bands, first Free Range Chickens and then Chicken Starship. And we were one of Seattle's finest chicken suit-wearing rock bands. And we just decided early on that we would wear chicken suits. And this was during the great grunge scare of the early 90s. And so that was kind of our gimmick. We were never like aspirational to being a legitimate rock band, but we had a lot of fun. So Free Range Chickens existed for a while. Then we broke up, and then we got back together. And I said, well, anytime a band gets back together when it really shouldn't and when its moment has passed, it needs the word Starship in the title.
Yes, and then We Built This City on Rock and Roll is the obvious result of that. Yes.
Well, but, some guys are in bowling leagues. Some guys are in softball teams. I've always been in rock bands. I'm in another band now, and it's I'm not going to be playing stadiums anytime soon, but it is so fun. I've always said I think everybody should be in a band. If you can't find a band, the government should appoint one for you. It should be like attorneys, and they'll just give you a band to report to and issue you a bass or some drums or whatever it is that you need to do. But it's honestly one of my favorite things to do in the world. And then with our show, with Wits, it helps me understand a lot of what we're working with the musicians, because they come in, they rehearse with our band very briefly, and we do some music bits in the show. We don't always have time to rehearse it, but having been in bands for so long, I can kind of get in the mindset of how to make a song assemble and how to make a comedy sketch assemble, so that it really helps.
If you want to hear Wits, you can listen Saturday nights at 9 o'clock on WNPR. The host is John Moe. He's also the moderator of the upcoming Connecticut Forum. It's tomorrow night called Nerdfest, Why Nerds Rule the World. Find out more information about ctforum.org. John Moe, great to talk to you. Thanks so much for doing this. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, John. We'll see you soon.
If you're a fan of Wits, check out a lightning round that we did with John Moe on WNPR.org. Where We Live is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. Thanks to two of our great interns, Skylar Magnoli and Jane Ashley, who are leaving us today. Good luck. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live, and we're going to leave you with a live song by John Moe and the band he mentioned, Chicken Starship. The song is called Fish on Fire. Have a great weekend.
Well, maybe you saw us down by the lake and you thought this must be some kind of mistake. I've never seen a fish before swimming around in a flaming pool, but it's not a mistake. We're the fish on fire. We live down there. We don't have a lot of friends. That's the way it goes. But we're trying to get involved in our community. You might think that we don't have any abilities, and sure, I could understand. You might think that way. What with the flames coming off our fins? But give us a break. It's not like we can get a job in a hardware store or in the county assessor's office. With no opposable thumbs and the fire.